Good afternoon, Gregory Lansky, 38515 from Mr. Miranda. This matter is a direct appeal after a trial where Mr. Miranda was convicted of a number of convictions and he's now serving an indeterminate 4-year-to-life sentence. For the purposes of today, I want to focus on the issue of the forensic interview of ES. I believe I was having to admit that 1-hour and 50-minute interview at trial. Specifically, there's two issues. One is whether it was admissible either by rules of evidence or statutory, or was there a confrontational issue. I'm going to start with the confrontation issue because I think that is the broader issue. And what happened here was that the ES testified, and the prosecutor only impeached ES about 7 times. The prosecutor impeached her. And that was the extent to this video, of the transcript of the video being into evidence. The situation is that there's a confrontational issue because the whole video, that 1-hour video, was not played when ES was on the stand. The prosecutor did not ask ES about specific statements which were on that video. So therefore, it's a very simple analysis, a confrontational analysis, that the defense did not ask the question. The video was not there during during her direct testimony, and therefore, because of that, there's a confrontation analysis because the ES was not asked specifically about those questions, and defense counsel Ms. Miranda did not have that ability to cross-examine on that.
Well, the prosecutor asked the judge if ES could be released, correct?
At that time.
Okay. Did the defense either object to her being released or ask that she be held so that she could be recalled?
But at that time, it was not clear whether that tape was going to be admissible or not.
Wouldn't that be a good reason for the defense counsel to say, I want this lady available for further cross-examination if the tape gets admitted?
But the issue is, number one, it pursuant to Melendez DSV in Massachusetts, it's the prosecutor's burden to produce the witness available for cross-examination.
She was there and could have been cross-examined.
But the prosecutor didn't introduce that video during her direct testimony. It was the prosecution's duty. They had control of their witnesses. They had control of their evidence. It was their duty, if they wanted to admit this evidence, to do it while she was on the stand.
In Melendez, there was no... The witness didn't come at all. Can you cite any cases where, similar to this one, where the witness was there, testified, and there was held to not be a right of confrontation?
Well, I think the Colorado case, the Colorado Supreme Court case on Marengo Ramirez was a Rule 21 issue. So I don't think this issue has ever been specifically addressed in Colorado.
Do you know any authority anywhere?
I don't, but if you look at the Sixth Amendment, if you look at what it says, and you have the right to confront witnesses that the prosecution produces, then if you just look at the scenario where the prosecution chooses not to ask about the video, play the video while ES is on the stand, it's unclear that this video is going to be admissible at any point during the trial. The court invited the prosecutor to do a child hearsay statute in limine hearing prior to trial, and the prosecutor declined. So under these circumstances...
Why would that have made a difference?
Would have made a difference because then they would have known whether this video would have been admitted or not. The court has the purpose of the child hearsay statute to give direction to the parties to say, hey, is this going to be admitted at the time? So then they can do their cross-examination at that time.
So is there authority that if you don't know for sure that that this is going to be admitted, you have no obligation whatsoever to cross-examine the witness with regard to it, or to request that the witness come back for cross-examination?
I think the issue is the following, and I believe with regards to if it's not clear whether this DVDs can be admitted, okay, it's not clear that the court can allow it to be admissible at trial, and it's not upon the defense counsel to say, hey, in order to exercise my Sixth Amendment confrontational rights, I want this witness to be here. because I don't know what's going to happen in the future. I don't know how the prosecutor is going to present their case.
Why, yeah.
It's not their burden. It's not the defense's burden. It's the prosecutor's burden. It's their case. They choose their order of witnesses. They chose the evidence. What is going on here to circumvent the hearsay statute? You know, because let's say the defense counsel during cross-examination starts asking questions about this video, which was not presented during the direct examination of ES. He's essentially what he's doing. He's waiving his right to object to the admission of this video, because now if he introduces parts which were not introduced during direct examination, for the rule of completeness, rule 106, he's essentially waiving his right to object. And the confrontation clause doesn't work like that. You don't waive your right to object in order to exercise your right to confront witnesses. The clause is clear. Look at the text of the clause. If you confront the witnesses that the evidence that's presented against the defendant, the prosecutor chose not to do it at this point, and the defendant should not be punished. It's the prosecutor's burden to have the witness available for cross examination.
Well, can I ask you, Mr. Lansky? I guess I'm a little concerned about where the line would be in this. Let's take a. I'm trying to come up with a hypothetical, and this may not have an exact. Witness testifies, prosecution witness is released. Later in the case, prosecution calls a different witness who testifies to X. And that's a question you may have wanted to cross-examine the witness on when the witness is there. It's a new fact about X that the witness didn't testify. Can you get up and say, well, now I've been denied my chance to cross-examine that witness. I would have liked to ask that witness about X. I didn't know the prosecution was going to put on X. It seems kind of analogous to me. And so I'd be interested in your response to that, but the cases seem to say if the witnesses were there, that satisfies your confrontation right. It's not on which specific question they ask.
But if you look at United States Supreme Court precedent, you look at Green, you look at Owen, and there's a quote in there. You know, the confrontation right is fulfilled if people present their case, they're asked about the hearsay statement, and they're given a full ability to cross-examine. Look at that sentence right there. That's a quote from the Supreme Court. How's that not happening in this case?
Well, let me try it this way. The court, outside the presence of the jury, heard extensive argument on whether the video would be admitted, correct?
Correct.
The defense counsel did not argue against the video on the specific basis that ES had been released, correct?
Well, he argues confrontation.
No. Did the defense counsel specifically tell the judge the problem is ES has been released?
Well, counsel did say, though, was that, hey, this is going to affect my confrontation rights. What is confrontation rights? The right to cross-examine, right, the witness.
The defense attorney did not say the problem is ES has been released, correct?
Well, at that time, too, the court didn't rule yet.
Yes, it did. The court heard argument, came back the next day.
And what happened the next day, immediately what the court said, cited to People v. Whitman, and said, he said, hey, the witness was here, and there's no confrontation issue. Okay? And then he made its ruling. The court already made its ruling. You know, it was done. The court already ruled to call the next witness. That's the day after the arguments were made. And the court made its decision, said, hey, this is not a confrontation issue, cited to People v. Whitman, and therefore, he never had the opportunity.
Well, I'm sorry, I don't understand that. Why couldn't defense counsel, the afternoon before, have told the judge, either number one, the problem is ES is gone, or number two, if you're going to admit the video, you must require the prosecution to have the lady available for cross?
Okay, number one, I believe that the defense sufficiently articulated that to the court based on their confrontation clause objection.
So you're saying that the generic reference to Crawford in the confrontation clause tells the judge that the lady has to be brought back into court?
What does confrontation clause to Crawford otherwise stand for? It stands for the ability to cross-examine the witness, right? Is there, what else does it stand for? That's what it stands for, and that's the objection that they were making at that time. And again, once the court ruled he lost his ability to recall, the court should have said, when it made its ruling, oh, we have a confrontation issue here, and therefore, you should have a right to recall. We never gave the defendant the opportunity to do so.
Did the defendant ever ask?
Because the court ruled previously.
No, I'm just.
I'm sorry.
I know you like to jump ahead and come up with another argument, but please answer our question.
Sure.
Did the defendant ever ask to have the witness recalled?
After the court ruled, there was no confrontation with.
Correct.
No.
Thank you.
Mr. Lansky, let me ask you a different question, just on the merits of this of the video. I'm telling you, your colleague, Ms. Grundy, here will hear this from me. I have some concerns about the admission of the entire video. But for you, tell me why it was harmful. What's the prejudice here? I mean, I get your argument that it was kind of both a prior consistent statement and a prior inconsistent statement. You can have it both ways. But it seemed like a lot of this evidence came in anyway. I understand your argument about the interviewer making these gratuitous statements, you know, I'm here to protect you and the like. I get that. Would you tell me why the admission of the whole video was prejudicial?
I think the best response to that is the prosecutor in this case when they were asking for the admission of the video. They said, I would not be making such a big deal if it was not so important to our case.
Well, the fact that it's important doesn't mean it's prejudicial. Obviously, anything they put on is probably prejudicial at some level.
Well, I think what happened, I think by all accounts, both by the prosecutor and by the court, that yes, his testimony, trial testimony wasn't that good. But there was a lot of issues with it. And that's why I think the prosecution in this case was really advocating for this video.
But the video is both helpful to them and not. I mean, there are inconsistent statements on that video.
Right.
So it kind of helped both sides at some level, didn't it?
I think it showed her in a different light. I think the prosecutor was looking for the demeanor because she was not subject to cross-examination at that time. There was inconsistencies in trial testimony. There's inconsistencies, you know, with VM's testimony and what was on the video. You know, what he said on that video to what VM went applied to those charges. It was more consistent, you know, in the video than what appeared on trial. There was these prejudicial statements by the interviewer. And just to have an hour and 15-minute video after the witness testified, I just think it's unfair. I think it's unfair what happened here. And those are the confrontations, but I also believe there's issues with regards to evidentiary rules, which I can get very quickly on, but I don't think it was admissible by them too. Child hearsay statute, issue that was not in the hearing. It didn't cover the subject matter of the child hearsay statute. In addition, in regards to the prior inconsistent statement, ES agreed to them during the direct examination, so you can't really prove that by extrinsic evidence. In regards to consistent statements, there's no allegation of recent fabrication or improper influence of the tape was done after that would occur. In regards to Evans and Ellie, those issues, number one, you can't admit it with substantive evidence, which the prosecutor did in this case. Number two, those cases deal with specific inconsistent statements brought out by defense counsel. That's the first common law rule regards to prior consistent statements. That was not done in this case. It was the prosecutor that impeached ES. It wasn't defense counsel the prior consistent statements. So the LA evidence does not apply in this situation.
Didn't defense counsel broadly attack ES's credibility by asserting that she contrived the allegations in their entirety because she didn't like the defendant's relationship with her mother?
Well, I think what happened here is that defense counsel is doing his job, saying he's pleading not guilty. And this is the reason why what ES is saying is not correct. And anytime you plead not guilty, that should not allow a prosecutor to introduce all prior consistent statements, especially for substantive purposes, which was done in this situation. And I think just by pleading not guilty, that should not open the door to that. I think that that would really impair the defendant's right to present a fair defense. If there's no questions, we'll 1 minute and 30 seconds left. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Erin Grundy, registration number 41271, and I represent the people. In this case, the child hearsay was properly admitted, and no confrontation violation exists because the victim testified and was subject to cross-examination at trial.
Well, I promised Ms. Grundy I was going to ask you something to jump right in. Tell me why this whole video comes in. I'll just give you a hint here. I have some trouble because the child hearsay statute says the acts come in, evidence about the acts. We have a whole bunch of testimony around this video of the interviewer saying, I'm here to protect you. nobody should go through this. It's not okay for someone to do this to you. How does that come in under the child hearsay statute number one? And how does this come in as a prior consistent statement, even assuming for argument's sake, credibility of the victim here was attacked? The prosecutor said it was not consistent. I'm just concerned this broad brush, the whole tape comes in, and I've seen a number of cases like this recently. It seems like it should be more specific. So could you address those issues?
Of course, Your Honor. Now, turning specifically to the scope of the child hearsay statute, I agree that 1325.129 talks specifically about describing incidents of sexual contact or penetration. So to the extent the video describes any of those acts, it's admissible. Now, in the specific context of child witnesses, it's also important for it to go through a little bit of the rapport building, and particularly the, do you understand what it means to tell the truth? Here are the rules of the interview. Because that's required for the jury's understanding of this context. And we see it a lot in terms of the interplay of child competency and the admissibility of child hearsay. And we can't tell the jury that this is admissible without establishing that the child is competent.
I think that's absolutely right. There's case law that says the context, some context could come in. This one seems to go way beyond that. But the examples that I gave where the interviewer is making these statements about it, this is not okay, I'm here to protect you, I'm here to keep you safe, that's quite troubling.
Your Honor, I think that also provides context for the interview. If you look to the recent line of cases out of our Supreme Court, and especially Davis, you're going to see that the court is looking at admitting the context of interviews. And even sometimes in Davis, commenting on the credibility of witnesses and the context of interviews, it explains how an interview is conducted. And that's what that type of testimony does here. And even if it may cross the line beyond the strict scope of 1325.129, because it does not specifically reference an act of sexual contact or penetration, it's admissible to explain the nature of the interview, to explain why specific questions are asked. And the forensic interviewer is also subject to cross-examination, which is an important component of this. Defense counsel can ask, why did you ask these questions? Prosecution can ask those questions as well. And defense can also certainly request a redaction. None was done here, and this issue was addressed prior to trial. We also know that the defense understood its ability to ask for redactions, as the defendant's own interview was redacted in this case, and redacted on relatively short notice. So that certainly would have been one option to correct any alleged prejudice. And the defense didn't specifically reference that in making the objections to the video at trial. Neither did the defense reference the ability to cross-examine ES statement by statement in the confrontation context. So there were a number of ways that if there is prejudice, this could have been corrected, but the defendant didn't ask for them. Now, in general, forensic interviews have been admissible. We look to Argomanes Ramirez, our Supreme Court told us, that they're admissible and don't violate the Confrontation Clause. If we look to DiBella, we see that forensic interviews are routinely admitted. Now, that doesn't mean that redaction couldn't have happened here. It simply means it wasn't requested. And to the extent that a forensic interview may go beyond the straight purview of either 801 or 1325.129 with its interplay of necessary information related to child competency, the burden should be on the defendant to request that those portions be redacted, because that's the way that the trial court can contemporaneously rule on it, and that the trial court can conduct the facts analysis to determine, does this provide context for the interview? Does this establish child competency? Is this related to the res geste of the offense, which many of the other statements may have been?
I'm going to come to that too. Well, if I can interrupt you, yeah, and I understand your argument about the hearsay statute. Tell me how this comes in as a prior, because the court let it in alternative, as a prior consistent statement after the victim's credibility was attacked, and the court kind of sat under that line of cases. How is this, the entire video, a prior consistent statement when the prosecutor, I can't remember, it was him, I think it was him, himself, cross-examined with inconsistent statements from the video?
And Your Honor, it's not the people's position that the entire video is a consistent statement. Some portions would have been admissible under 801's prior inconsistent statement. Those specific, I believe it's 7 points that the defense pointed out in their brief, would have been admissible as inconsistent statements. Now, in terms of the evidence line of cases, which is when a child's when a witness's credibility has been generally attacked, prior consistent statements can be admissible to rehabilitate a witness. And we look to in terms of determining how much is admissible, we look to the scope in which the witness's credibility has been attacked. Here, the defense broadly attacked the witness's credibility, and in the opening statement said that the jury was there for the inventive story of a young girl. So it's not simply an act of pleading not guilty. It's based in part on the defense opening statement. It's based in part on the questions that were asked specifically of the ES by the defense counsel, as well as those questions asked of her mother. It's clear that there's a general attack on the credibility, and that's what brings it in under the Evans line of cases under 801.
Well, bring in parts of it, right? I mean, not the whole tape. I mean, so I think your position is some pieces came in because it was child hearsay statute, some pieces came in as inconsistent, some pieces came in as consistent.
That's true, and if we look to the language of the child hearsay statute, it says specifically the child hearsay statute is only triggered if it's not admissible under another rule or statute. So if it's admissible under 801, by definition, it can't be admissible under the child hearsay statute. So I don't think it's necessarily going to be uncommon for some parts. If it's a prior inconsistent statement, it will be admissible under 801. But if we look to the whole video, it captures those portions that weren't admissible under 801 under the child hearsay statute.
I appreciate it, Ms. Grant. I'm sorry to monopolize your time, but my concern is one other issue that's of concern to me is this res gestae kind of piece. There are kind of six or seven different acts that the court let in as res gestae, and I'm concerned about that. Things that the ES said, defendant on the couch, masturbating or playing with his junk, I think she said. There was some just this list of incidents. The court let in as res gestae. I'm concerned about how that could be. There's no time frame listed on any of these. This is why we don't know when they occurred. Res gestae, of course, is necessary to explain or understand the incidents at issue. So two things. I'm not sure I understand how these seven acts are necessary for the jury's understanding of the two incidents that were ultimately charged here. That's number one. And then related to that, I hear a lot of argument about grooming in this case. I don't see how this is any of this is grooming, that the man is sitting on his couch, quote, playing with his junk. How is that grooming? I mean, I think of grooming as kind of leading the victim towards a place where an assault happens, or that they were, defendant would stare at her a lot, and he was creepy. How is that grooming? Again, this is broad brush to let all this in. I'm going to posit to you that this feels more to me like other acts evidence. And if we get there, none of the 404B requirements were satisfied, the procedure requirements. I don't see a specific evidential hypothesis. So long-winded question, but address how this comes in as res gestae, how it's grooming, why isn't it 404B?
It comes in as res gestae because it is part and parcel to the offense in that it establishes the pattern count. If we look, the defendant was specifically charged with sexual assault as a part of a pattern of abuse. He was acquitted of that charge, but evidence was admissible for all of the charges that were presented to the jury, including the pattern count. It establishes the nature of this offense. It also establishes...
Hey, let me interrupt you. How is he sitting on the couch playing with his junk part of the pattern of abuse on her, or that he looks at her creepily? That's not abuse.
Your Honor, that may not be abuse, but it does demonstrate the relationship that the defendant has with the victim. And we see in child sexual assault cases that that relationship can be critical to the jury's understanding because it shows how the defendant gets access. It shows, if we look to the reviewing pornography and specifically the Buttman magazine that the child references, pornography can be an act of grooming. All of this together shows how the defendant shows the defendant's relationship with the victim, shows how he had access to the victim on the night in question, as well as the other charged incidents. And it also shows just the child's general understanding of what was happening and why it was happening. This is important to show the defendant's intent as well. Now, the trial court admitted this primarily under a res gestae theory. And while we require that it be contextual and that it's not so distinct to be a different time or a different occurrence, res gestae doesn't put a specific limit as to when the events must have happened. Now, the defense cites to Medina in their brief as an example of when the temporal requirement is too separated, but that's the defendant's statements 2 years after the charged events. Here, we're close in proximity because we know that the mother only lived with this man for a fairly limited period of time. The victim's testifying that it's in the time that her mother lived with him, so we have some temporal limitation on this as well to show the race justice. Now, as far as the court's other question regarding the 404B, whether we get there, the court primarily admitted it under race justice, which I think is why it didn't do the complete photo analysis. However, we also know from the 10th Circuit's opinions that the lack of articulating a specific evidentiary hypothesis may not be fatal to a claim, particularly when it's apparent in the record. Here, it would be to intent and grooming, which we know is statutorily admissible in sex assault cases. So we're going to the defendant's intent. We're going to what he intended from these acts, and particularly the other acts that the defendant was actually acquitted of, specifically the vaginal touching incident. So in general, this was admissible under res geste, and if it was not admissible under res geste, it's not fatal to the claim under 404B. And in any event, it would have been harmless, given that the jury acquitted of all of the other acts except for the specific truth or dare incident in the car. So to the extent that the jury found this persuasive, it was harmless, as it did not contribute to the defendant's convictions. The truth or dare incident was supported not only by ES's testimony, but also by BM's testimony. The defendant admitted that he had been in the car with the children on that day, and it was also supported by the forensic evidence of the semen-covered rag found in the defendant's car exactly as the victim described. So in any event, it would have been harmless, even if there was an error in the 404B or res geste admissibility. Does that answer the court's question?
Thank you very much.
And in turning to the confrontation component of the child hearsay statute, I believe Argomendez-Ramirez squarely deals with this issue. It was Rule 21, but it deals specifically with the question of the admissibility of forensic interviews when a victim testifies at trial. It is admissible. Our Supreme Court has already articulated this. That was a 2004 case. The trial court would have had the benefit of that had they looked at it. And I believe it squarely addresses this issue. The Crawford does nothing to change the confrontation analysis when a victim testifies and is subject to cross-examination. It does not allow a defendant repeated attempts at cross-examination over every sentence that a victim may say that's slightly different. Further, the defendant could have recalled the victim. We have no indication that she wasn't available. We know that her brother testified in the defendant's case in chief. We see that the family was likely present during the general context of the case. The defendant did not object to releasing the witness. The defendant did not raise the issue in the context of his ability to cross-examine. And the Confrontation Clause does not require a defendant to be able to go sentence by sentence through everything a witness may have said. Instead, it is satisfied when a witness is subject and available for cross-examination. And that's precisely what happened here.
Is it the Attorney General's position that the confrontation branch of this argument is unpreserved because the defendant never raised it specifically with the court?
Your Honor, we agree that the defendant did raise confrontation at the time that he objected to the admissibility of child hearsay statements in general. So while I don't believe the court had the opportunity to specifically address confrontation in this context, we agree that the defendant did constitutionalize his objection at trial. So the court can do with that what it deems appropriate.
Okay.
And if this court has no further questions, the people respectfully request that this court affirm the defendant's convictions.
Let me ask you one quick question.
Of course.
On the list, the past recollection recorded,
right.
at least one of the events that's listed on there took place 3 years before the list was prepared. How does that meet the at or near the time requirement of Rule 835?
Your Honor, that one may be slightly outside the scope. The others we see are fairly closely connected to the time of the charged incidents. Even if that one is outside the scope, then it's harmless given the jury's acquittal on the pattern count as well as the acquittal on the other counts. Now, had the defendant raised the specific objection that this charge or this particular component was too far outside the scope, then the court certainly could have addressed it. But because it wasn't raised, the court didn't have an opportunity to limit the past recollection recorded in that nature.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just with regards to that list, think the time limit that the prosecutor did during the motion hearing for this was within 3 years. So, number one, it goes to the res gestae evidence, which shows that it wasn't within the time limit, it wasn't the era of time. The crime was not part and parcel of the crime because of this 3 year window. And then, two, it goes to the party recollection argument for the fact that that note was not made at or near the time of these events when it occurred.
Did the defense raise that specific argument below that it was not contemporaneous?
Well, the defendant objected on hearsay grounds for the admission of that note.
Did the defendant specifically raise the timing question?
Well, the court ruled right after the hearsay objection was made. The court ruled, say, this is a prior recorded recollection, it's admissible. And one other issue I want to highlight to the court, that not only was this note displayed on an overhead projector, but also, based upon the record, it looks like it was actually given to the jury when they were doing the deliberations, part of the evidence, the other evidence was given. So you have an issue with regards to that, and I believe it's prejudicial. I believe prejudicial because the fact shows that other attempts were made at that time. And with that, I ask for my clients to just reverse. And I apologize if I was emotional in my arguments. I apologize. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments from both counsel, emotional and otherwise. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. We will issue a written opinion in due course.